I'm Jay.
And I'm Frankie.
Thank you for listening to the Grill Coach Podcast.
Oh, yes, it's about that time to light it up and go outside. We're chilling, grilling up sides and drinks, rubs and recipes and cooking techniques. Outdoor cooking, grilling, smoke and barbecue. So much flavor to teach and learn and share with you. Grill Coaches Podcast to level up your game with Frankie, Wes, and Jay.
Hey, welcome to the Grill Coach Podcast. I'm Jay, your host, and today I'm here with Frankie. What's up, Frankie?
Hey, Jay, how's it going? Happy Thursday. What is
Thursdays?
What
is the days? Thursdays are the way we do this. and it's no secret; it's to get you ready for the weekend. You, the listener, get you fired up about grilling. Friday after work, you go get all your stuff, and then Friday night you prep your meats. Saturday morning, you light up the grills, the smokers, whatever. And then you make everybody around you happy. So that's the whole, I don't know if we ever explained. That's why we do this on Thursday, but yeah.
Now you know the secret behind the magic.
Hey, so I made a new friend, Mr. Adrian Miller. He's the author of Black Smoke, one of the latest books out, talks about the history of barbecue. I think it's something that you're really going to find interesting, something that, you know, we need to learn. And it's always about paying homage to how did we get here and how did stuff happen that we do today, and even just appreciate the cultures and even how things have changed over generations. But first, before we get Adrian Miller on, let's talk highlights. Frankie, I need to take a drink of water. So you go.
All right. So let's see. I got to do some barbecuing, in the wild. Well, not in the wild, in my backyard. So I'm happy about it. I was at the, store, and I was kind of just like impulse buying things. I was like kind of in a rush, wanting to like come in under budget, and I found some country style pork shoulder ribs, and I thought I was on something new.
Okay,
because those are just country style ribs, right?
Yeah, which they're not really ribs. Yeah,
which they're not ribs. Which I knew that going into it.
Okay, all right.
But I thought I was like, oh, I found something new. No one has seen this before. But no, it was just the same thing after another Google search. So
the butcher said, hey, watch me sell this. Those aren't selling. What do you do? Watch me change the name.
Boom. Real quick, too. I was like, oh, I'll take that, sir. Put it in my cart. So either way, I thought it'd be fun. I wanted to cook these on the pit barrel because that is closest to my door currently. And it was a beautiful. It started off as a beautiful weekend, and it was like, you know, overcast but sunny when I started. So I bride them for 24 hours, and then I just put some buttery steakhouse, a little bit of black pepper, and then a little bit of sugar, it's a slightly sugary based rub that I usually use for chicken, but I did a light coating of that on that just to help with some color
right?
And sweetness.
Yeah.
But I was going to put it on, or I bought it. So there's like seven of them. It's they're massive. It's a lot of stuff for like $11, which is another reason why I wanted to buy it. But
those
like,
are well, always cheap cuts of meat. Yeah, those are they get you because they're cheap cuts of meat.
Yeah, I was like, but I'll put the time and love it needs. But as I was prepping it, I was like, oh wait, all these are not going to fit on my pit barrel. I can only fit like two and a half
planning,
of those things.
Poor planning.
I know. So I was like, oh, it's no problem. I will just hang them. You know, it'll be okay.
I like that.
Boom. Okay. So going to prep, I only have four hooks. I'm like, oh, wait, what am I going to do now? But crisis averted, I realized that the little grate I had was that little half hinge grate. So once I figured out how to make that hinge go down, flip it upside down, I was set. So put them on, and then came inside and I left them. I like set them and left. Like I was going to, like if I would do like a whole pork shoulder. So I was not very active in the supervision of this cooking.
Okay.
So it was still good. I mean, probably went like half an hour longer than I should have let it be out there. But I go out there and it is pouring rain. I maybe took a little disco nap in between applying and then going to switch those. So I was like, oh shoot. But it was fine because it was time for them to come off. So I ended up just finishing them on the oven with some barbecue sauce, some vinegar, some additional seasonings.
They're so you, glaze some sauce on them in the oven?
Yeah, I just left them in the oven to finish off. So it was good. They're so delicious. I still got tons of them left. I'm not quite sure how we're going to, what we're going to do with them for the rest of the week, but I'm sure we will get creative.
No shame in finishing them also in the oven. And man, I think you're already very creative, you know, just hearing you go through the process, just getting a new meat you haven't, you know, dealt with, didn't plan on how you were going to cook it, mixing it up with the rubs. And it's just, yeah, it's just, you're creating, and it's like using all those senses, right? And just like figuring out how to do stuff. And I think what's one of the best things about us barbecue people is that we figure it out.
Yay, right? You know, I realized though today I was not using all my senses when I finished cooking yesterday, because I checked in the backyard, you know, just casually. I was like looking while I was like putting laundry in the washer. I don't know. But yesterday I light my chimney when I do a pit barrel. I light the chimney on my kettle.
Okay.
And never closed the lid to the kettle. And so it has proceeded to be raining for like 24 hours. So the inside of my kettle is trashed right now. And I'm like, oh, shoot. So it'll be a fun cleaning weekend.
Just put a bunch of lump charcoal, let it burn.
Let it go, right?
Favorite way to clean the kettle, just let it burn. Yeah. The laziest way. All right. Well, hey, I love that story. And, you know, it just goes to encourage, you know, anybody out there listening. Sometimes we don't really know what it's going to look like in the end when we're cooking. And it's just, you know, having the confidence just to sort of get in there and try it out. I did want to ask, Frankie, so what temperature did you smoke these to? Well, it sounded like you just smoked them until it rained too much. So, but did you have a goal in mind?
Not necessarily. I knew I wanted to get a certain amount of color on there, and I knew I was wanting to do about 3 hours.
Okay.
I didn't really go for a temp, which I should have, of course, because then I would have took them off a little sooner like I wanted to. So the little ends that were hanging, you know, closest to the fire got a little too charred. Uh-huh. And they were definitely like already kind of falling, ready to be like falling apart.
Well, you can take those little nuggets and drop them in some beans or something like that, and they'll flavor the beans, and then you can pull that thing out and toss it. Ooh. You know, but you get all the smoked charry flavor into your beans.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I just came up with that.
Dang, and learned something new.
Bam. All right. Don't waste that smoke. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, I had a colleague of mine. He sent me this message about grilled potato salad. And it was a German style potato salad. So instantly intrigued, you know, because it has grilled. And obviously he knows I do this. So he's like, yeah, I thought of you. And he even said, you know, he made it like 7 or 8 times. And he sort of enjoyed that. But man, it was pretty interesting to put potatoes on the grill and use that to make your potato salad from.
Like little chopped potatoes?
Put the whole potato on there and poke some holes in them. Just like if you were to put them in the oven, just put them on the grill. Pull them off the grill, peel the potatoes. You know, you want to get them where they're really like, you know, not too soft, but sort of fork tender. So then you get them off there, let them cool, peel the skins off, and then you make your potato salad out of that. And the recipe is mixed with bacon, and you actually use the bacon grease with onion as your dressing for your potato salad.
Are you talking my language?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It's like, yeah, take some chopped onions. You cook the bacon in a pan. Take some chopped onions. You cook those onions in a pan. You get that fond off the pan. And you sort of kind of mix all of that up. And I think you might even throw some butter in there, to be honest with you. I couldn't remember exactly off the top of my head. But now you got this really rich type of, you know, dressing. And then I think you definitely do add vinegar. And vinegar and sugar, the original recipe calls. And he, I remember he told me specifically, he kind of likes his a little more on the sourness side, the acidic side. So they get a little more heavy on the vinegar or forego the sugar or something like that. But with that, and then mix that potato and with the bacon, and then it's like all finished off with fresh chopped parsley, you know, gave it some great color and some more balance. fantastic side.
Chef's kiss.
Yeah, yeah. So, oh man, got to try that again. So definitely, you know, hey, want you everybody to try that. Maybe I'll go crazy and write a recipe, because I haven't wrote a recipe on our site for a long time about the grilled potato salad. I'll probably make it again and try to really document the process. You know, I'll put that one in my wheelhouse. Frankie's going to make a brisket. I'll do a recipe, grilled potato salad. We got some tasks.
I know. I don't want to start collecting bets on who's going to do what first.
All right. Let's get to the next part of the show. Man, I can't wait to get Adrian Miller on. But let's talk listener questions. What do we got?
Question tonight is using a custom salt, pepper, and garlic rub good to use on burgers? I would say, so this is like a AP rub, right?
That's exactly what I thought of. I thought of Malcolm Reed and his AP seasoning. You know, I thought of, you know, so many of the Dalmatian rubs, the brisket rubs, even the Santa Maria rubs from the tri-tip in the Central Coast, because it's always, you know, with beef, salt, pepper, garlic. And one thing, let's just remind everybody, salt and pepper on protein is good. It don't matter what protein, it's always, you know, those are the magic things. Listen to the episode on salt, you know, it does wonders. But salt and pepper does a great thing. The garlic, I feel like the garlic could be an X factor. And maybe, Frankie, I just feel your palate's better than mine. But, you know, I'm going to give you that one. But I think sometimes the garlic doesn't really bring anything to the party unless it's, like, really fragrant.
Mm. I feel like it must help with that, like, fragrance and maybe, like, a little more of, I don't know, I'm going to say umaminess, but, like, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's a little more heartiness sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I'll taste the dry garlic, you know, wherever that is or something like that. And I just don't really get anything. I'm just not really tasting much. And it just makes me think, you know, buy that big old thing at Costco and it's been sitting in my cupboard for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I think it loses its potency, you know, because it doesn't even smell like anything. So it's like, I feel like you got to get the little sauce bottles. I feel like maybe it just has a really low shelf life. And, but kind of like anything in barbecue, sometimes we do stuff and it doesn't change anything, but we feel better because we did it.
Yep.
You know, I don't know if you're going to taste tradition. Garlic, right? Like, oh, but what's really going to come out with those proteins is the salt and pepper. Let's just be honest. You know, the salt is always in the front, pepper's on the back, you know? So. To answer the question, yeah, salt and pepper, garlic rub. Yeah, I would say it's good on burgers.
Can I play devil's advocate?
Sure.
So wasn't it
Amazing
Meathead,
Ribs?
Yeah, from Amazing Ribs, who talks about how you shouldn't apply salt until right before you go to cook a burger?
Excellent. You are absolutely right. And I was thinking about bringing that up, but I don't know if I remember it all, and I was worried about misquoting our friend Meathead, but he did say, like, if you mix in the salt when you're mixing your burger patty, then it does something and it creates a denser patty, like where it's going to be more dense. It's not going to be so airy and light. And it had to do something about with the moisture, something about, you know, with, I don't know, the good stuff that happens when we dry brine other proteins, it actually works bad when you do a burger. That's the moral to the story.
All right. Hey, I'll buy it. I follow the rule either way.
but yeah, I think, you know, adding it, you know, right before you cook it, that's the way to do it. And so thanks for clarifying that, fellow grill coach. All right. Next segment. Grill coach recommends. What we got?
Let's see. This week we got, surprise, surprise, we're going to do some more books. We're going to talk about Black Smoke by Adrian Miller, as Jay talked about in the beginning of the show. And then we're also going to recommend his first book, which he won a James Beard Foundation Book Award for, Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. And then his most recent book, Black Smoke, which is about the history of barbecue. And we are going to thoroughly dive into that after the show. So I encourage you all to check that out. I will make sure to include links to this on our show notes at thegrillcoach.com, where you should go to sign up for our newsletter to make sure you are subscribed for all of our updates, Grill Coach recommendations, newsletters, and other good information. Speaking of the website, I encourage everyone to go check it out, thegrillcoach.com. Big thanks and shout out to our patrons. Your support goes to supporting website hosting, podcast hosting, so we can keep creating this barbecue community.
All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to be back with Mr. Adrian Miller.
Hey, everyone, I'm Rusty Monson, and I am sitting here with the Anthony Lujan,
hosts of the Pitmasters podcast.
And you're listening to the Grill Coach podcast with Jay, Wes, and Frankie.
Hey, welcome back to the Grill Coach podcast. Today we got Adrian Miller, the author of the book Black Smoke. Just a quick blurb on Adrian. Adrian Miller is a certified Kansas City Barbecue Society judge and the recipient of a James Beard Foundation Book Award for the book Soul Food. It's a surprising story of an American cuisine, one plate at a time. He was a consultant on the Netflix show Chef's Table Barbecue. Mr. Miller's second book was The President's Kitchen Cabinet. It's the story of African Americans who have fed our first families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. I find that incredible because I just watched with my sons The Butler, where the guy like served for like eight presidents. It's probably like all in the same area.
Oh, yeah. No, it stretches beyond that, man. So every president has had an African American cooking for them in some capacity. So there's been a brother or sister in the presidential kitchen since George Washington, all the way to President Biden.
Wow. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. That's current, y'all, today. So, Adrian, hey, man, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, man, good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your cooking background.
Yeah, so I started cooking at an early age. My mother worked nights. And so when she got home from work, she was too tired to cook breakfast for the other kids. I have several brothers and sisters, but I had a twin sister and a younger brother. We were around the same age. And so we were growing up together. So we had to take turns making breakfast for each other once a week. And look, this was not glorious stuff. I mean, it was scrambled eggs with eggshells, maple, pancakes, you know, stuff like that. And then when I got older, I had a little more confidence in cooking. So I would make stuff to give my mom a break on the weekend. So my first thing I remember making was something back in the day, they called it Indian tacos, but it was essentially fry bread with, taco toppings on it. So almost imagine like a tostada, except you had fry bread instead of a hard corn tortilla. So that was the most complicated thing that I've made first. And it was good, man. You know,
sounds delicious.
Then college, law school, took a break from cooking, but then my third year in law school, I had a couple of job offers, so I was easing back a little bit from the grind, and I was watching these cable TV shows. And back then, it was Discovery Channel had this great chefs series, and they were featuring chefs from just all around the country. And it was gourmet stuff. And I was watching one show, and I said, hey, you know what? I think I can make that. And so I started practicing.
Like we all do. With that.
Yeah. And then, you know, it was hit or miss. But, you know, again, I started getting more confidence and stuff. And so the biggest achievement at that age, right, as a young man is I invited a woman over for dinner and I made her a salmon burger with sweet potato fries. Ooh. And when I presented the plate to her, she's like, oh, this is something like you'd get in a restaurant. I was
like, yes. Winning.
So then after that, just start, you know, just cooking for myself. But these days, I cook. I'm known in around Denver. This is where I live, for making soul food dinners for charity. So I'll come over to somebody's place and I'll make a dinner, soul food dinner, for 8 to 10 people. And usually it'll be some fried chicken, some Creole broiled catfish, greens, black eyed peas, mac and cheese, some coleslaw, and then like some kind of cornbread. It could be hush puppies or cornbread. And then usually some kind of dessert, maybe like a peach cobbler or a peach crisp, something like that.
Wow, these things sound incredible. So I imagine that they're in your book, Soul Food. And we're having a link on our site so you guys can get this book and get some of these recipes. I'm sure they come right out of there. because you got to deliver what you say, right? You got to.
Yep, exactly. Yep. So a lot of these recipes are in the book, or books, I should say. They're spread across the books. Yeah. Because each book has some recipes in it.
All right. So barbecuing much, doing a lot of grilling. What kind of smokers you have?
Yeah. So I don't get to barbecue much because I live in a high rise condo. And the fire code, you know, just won't let me smoke meat like the way I want to. And, you know, I'm allowed to have a propane gas setup. But look, I'm just not going to do that to you as my guest in my home. So when I do cook, I go to my dad's where I grew up. And he's got a old school double oil drum smoker. So I cook on that when I barbecue. But it's really mainly just for the holidays that I do it. And then the grill equipment has been passed to me officially. So Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day. Those are the big days for us for barbecue.
So you get over there. Here's the tongs. All right.
Yeah. You're in charge.
Yeah.
hopefully at least somebody lights the fires for you. You got some young cousins around there. Hey.
Nope.
Start the internship.
Nobody's
soon.
Doing that.
I do like the small flex that you said, yeah, when I was in law school. So I'm thinking Mr. Man's a lawyer, you know, not just, you know, any old dude. So congrats, man. That's awesome.
Thank you. I am a recovering lawyer. I should say that. I was in the game for like 4 years. And then, you know, I got to the point where I was singing spirituals in my office. So I figured I needed to do something else. And, you know, it's messed up because white people were joining in. So that's how rough it is in law firms.
In the lawyer world. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, onto happier things then. I would love to hear how you got interested into writing about barbecue specifically in your writing journey.
Yeah, so I was already working on a book on soul food. And originally, the way I wrote the soul food book is I created a representative soul food meal. And I wrote a chapter about every part of the meal and I explained what it is, how it gets on the soul food plate, what it means for the culture. And so many soul food restaurants have a barbecue option. So I figured, okay, well then, you know, let me write about barbecue. But I found so much stuff on barbecue that I said, nah, it doesn't feel right to just write a chapter on African-American barbecue. So I said, well, let me write a book about it. And so I was working on my soul food book. But at the same time, I was gathering information on barbecue. And I think a seminal moment came when I was watching the Food Network. And this was 2004, and at that time, the Food Network was really ramping up its barbecue coverage. So it had multiple shows and stuff going on. And so there was an ad for Paula Deen Southern Barbecue. So I said, you know what, let me just watch this, because I'll find out the leading trends in barbecue and who are the people that are being followed, you know, getting the shine. And 60 minutes later, when the credits were rolling, I just realized that no Black people were featured on that show. So I thought two things. The first thing I thought was, like, you know, this is 2004. How's this even happen? Because this does not square with my experience with barbecue. And then the second thing I thought is, well, maybe I got it twisted. Maybe it was an ad for Paula Deen Scandinavian barbecue sponsored by Alabama White Sauce, and I just wasn't paying attention. So I started looking at other media, TV shows, newspapers, magazines, and it was the same thing, man. You know, Black people were either pushed to the sidelines of barbecue storytelling or left out altogether. And, you know, that's just whack because African-Americans have significantly contributed to what this thing we call barbecue in the U.S. And so my book, Black Smoke, is a thump on the head to say, look, if you're going to talk about barbecue in the U.S., you have to include African-Americans.
Definitely, you know, feel your sentiment on that. And that's when, you know, just coming across your book made it so like, well, wow, how come we haven't really talked about this? You know, we kind of treat barbecue as for everyone, you know, and it's just kind of equally, but it's different when you got to pay respects to how did we get here, you know, and how did that happen? And respecting the other cultures, because we've done other shows on Mexican barbecue, Italian barbecue, and just different around the world. And it came at a real good time for us to sort of like, hey, let's look at that. Let's appreciate that. And I really love sort of like that story that you brought to the table.
Yeah. And again, it's just astonishing. Now, you know, I knew that barbecue was a part of African-American cooking. But I have to say, until I started writing this book, I didn't know how deeply we shaped barbecue traditions in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I had no idea the depth of it. I just knew that it was important to Black people. And so once I saw that, I had a greater appreciation for what all these brothers and sisters did over the course of several centuries to get us to this point.
I got to say, too, the wealth of information that you seem to gather in your book. I have the paper copy and I got it on audiobook. And the audiobook does not do it justice, because looking at some of these old advertisements, some of these old pictures, it really like highlights, you know, what you're talking about in the illustrations. Especially there was a, you know, there's a guy by the fire, you know, and you talked about he was shown as like very respected, you know, a master of his trade and things like that. And it just really like showed a different light to then 2004. It's like not even a part of it anymore.
Yeah, you know, and I know what the image you're thinking about is one that was for a barbecue sauce in like 1907 or something. And so one thing that was really interesting to me is given how much Black people shaped barbecue, I'm really surprised that there was not an Aunt Jemima, Faustus, Uncle Ben type figure that emerged to sell barbecue. Because it would have been very much in line with how Black people were used to sell these other products. So I'm just surprised that didn't happen. And so that figure that we got on the Georgia barbecue sauce label was the closest. But again, he wasn't. He was very respected, treated respectfully. And it was about legitimacy, right? Because for people at that time, they knew that if you were going to get the good stuff, it was likely to be cooked that way over a pit by an African American. Mm. I mean, African Americans for a long, 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 long time were the standard bearers for delicious barbecue.
Can you just quickly kind of share with us, you know, in the book, it goes way into detail. So listeners, make sure you get the book to get the full story. But you talk about the transition from Native Americans to African-American slaves and how, you know, that happened. And the other thing that was really highlighted to me is that back in the days, they're not barbecuing a leg or this or that. It was always whole animals. And I'm just like, wow, how come I never even thought about that? But if you could just kind of describe that, that transition.
Yeah. So, you know, not everybody agrees with this and they're wrong. But barbecue starts with Native Americans. You know, Columbus and his crew, the first people they see cooking this way were the indigenous people in the islands in the Caribbean. And the word barbecue came from what the Spanish people heard the indigenous people calling the raised platform of sticks that had iguanas, other meat and vegetables on it that was being slowly smoked. So it was barbacoa in Spanish, and the word barbecue is the English approximation of the Spanish. So it's like a game of historical telephone. So You've got this raised platform in the Caribbean, but that's not the pit method of the South, because the way the barbecue emerges in the South was digging a trench, few feet deep, few feet wide, filling it with wood, burning it down the wood into coals. While that's happening, butchering animals and butterflying them. Could be pigs, sheep, goats. They did cows, but the cows are so big, they'd have to quarter them in order to cook them. And, you know, somebody's job was to continuously flip that meat over those coals. And then somebody else maintained a separate fire to replenish coals where there were cold spots. And then another person had to have a bucket of vinegar with spices to go and just occasionally swab the meat and moisten it, you know? So this is very labor intensive. And so my argument is that the pit method that we talk about in the South was based on how Native Americans were cooking meat. And they had a method where they would have a shallow pit, you know, hand dug, and they would put a mix of rocks and wood in there, set that on fire. And it's ingenious, right? Because the heat of the rocks would continue cooking long after the fire had gone out. And then they would take the meat, and they were butchering usually like just like chunks of meat, right? And they would put it right on the coals to cook. Mm-hmm. And so later, when you get colonizing Europeans and enslaved Africans, they bring their meat cooking traditions. And all of a sudden, that shallow pit gets sticks set across it so that you could lay meat above the cooking. The shallow pit becomes deeper, and then the European animals are cooked over this. So then, based on that Native American template, it gets us on the road to what we would later call Southern pit barbecue. So you could see the antecedents of it in Native American cooking and European cooking and African cooking and smoking, but it starts to become something different. with that interaction, you know, over the years.
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned in the book, too, that you had instances where slaves were allowed to sell barbecue.
Oh, yeah. So let me just back up. You know, when we are educated for the most part about slavery in this country, we get the broad strokes. We really don't have a sense for how slavery operated and how people lived their lives day in and day out.
It's only what we get in the movies, bro. It's only what we get in the movies. You know, people aren't reading.
Yeah, exactly. So I had no idea how much of there was an informal economy on plantations, because slavery as an economic system was inefficient. And so a lot of times slaveholders were trying to figure out, how am I going to make money out of this situation? But they were so invested in white supremacy that they would forego, even though they were losing money and stuff, they still got status from having slaves, right? So they were doing goofy stuff. But what some of the slaveholders decided that they would let their enslaved people go to a nearby towns and sell foods and goods and other things, and they would take a cut of what the enslaved people sold. And so that was a way of making some money. So they were, they were definitely allowed to sell a barbecue. And in that case, a barbecue was not only sold in a nearby town, sometimes it was sold on the edge of a plantation to people living on neighboring plantations. And then poor whites and Native Americans would come to the perimeter of the plantation for trade. So there was a lot of stuff going on, not just with barbecue, but all kinds of foods.
So let me just put two and two together real quick. One time we talked about, you know, there's a famous quote. I can't remember who said it. Like, if you want to be a good barbecuer, griller, smoker, whatever that is, it's all about the size of your ash pile, right? You got to get through a bunch of cooks and this and that. So what we're saying is the majority of people around those times were enslaved, you know, and they are the ones that were building up that ash pile. And we even say on this show, you're cooking with all your senses. And so you're out there, it's like you're learning the nuances of all of what it takes to put this together. So it is kind of interesting, like you said, it didn't end up with somebody's face on something, you know, that we still see today.
Yeah. And the reason why enslaved African Americans were the ones doing this, because it was labor intensive. I mean, somebody had to clear the field. Somebody had to do all of that prep work. Somebody had to serve the food, do the cleanup, and then provide the entertainment. And so that was Black people from A to Z. So barbecue for most of our nation's history was a Black experience. And because it was labor intensive and they didn't want to pay people, they made enslaved African-Americans do that work.
Interesting.
So I have a question. So this idea of what we can now consider, you know, barbecue and its prominence from African-American community in the South, how did that maybe expand across over history? Did that expand across into them becoming like an authority figure and a more prominent figure in the barbecue community?
So by the time you get to the 19th century, it is just established that if you're going to talk about barbecue and who's making the good stuff, it's African-Americans. So then after the Civil War, you have enslaved African-Americans, now free, formerly enslaved, right, and now free, emerging with this very lucrative and marketable skill, because people still want a barbecue. But, you know, Black people are the ones that made it. So they were put on trains, stagecoaches, and boats all across the country to bring a taste of Southern barbecue to places that normally wouldn't get it. So that further enhanced the reputation. What does start to change, though, by the time you get to the turn of the 20th century, is you start getting white men involved in barbecue, because I think they see how lucrative it is and how beloved it is. And so when you start getting white men involved, they start getting the press and the publicity for this, even though most of them rely on an all Black workforce. So that happens. And then the second thing that happens at the turn of the century, that's really 20th century, that's really significant, is barbecue, as the country is becoming more urbanized. So then barbecue moves from a rural context to an urban context. And so that's when you start seeing this focus shift from whole animal cooking to cooking smaller cuts of meat. Because it's just, you know, doing whole animal cooking is not so easy to do in an urban context, except for maybe like a special occasion. But if you're going to, you know, doing it in a restaurant and stuff, it's not as easy to do that. So a lot of people started, that's when we start getting ribs, brisket, sausages, chicken, all these smaller cuts, pork shoulder, those kind of things. So there's a time in the early 20th century where you get a flood of white people getting into barbecue. And then by the time you get to the 1920s and 30s, you start seeing a whole bunch of barbecue restaurants for sale because people didn't know what they were doing. And then black people kind of reassert their dominance in the field after that kind of gold rush, that mini gold rush. And then, you know, for decades, most people in urban areas got their taste of barbecue from an African-American. Not exclusively, right? There were plenty of white people who barbecued, but it was usually the black joints that were highly revered and the ones that got the most traction. And one of the interesting things is even during Jim Crow, white people wouldn't come into the black part of town for soul food, right? But they would come for barbecue. And I think it's because soul food and Southern food were similar enough. And then a lot of white families had a black cook that they could get soul food in pretty much anytime they wanted, Southern soul. But to get barbecue, you had to go to that person, usually a man, that did it well. And so it was just a really interesting dynamic.
So I might be jumping the gun here, but I don't see a lot of black owned barbecue joints even today. And is this a fallout from, you know, some of this media, or, you know, what do you think that is about?
I think there's a lot of things going on. I think one is a lot of the black joints that were started in the 40s, 50s and 60s, and maybe even the 70s, you know, you've got the owners that want to either retire and pass the business along to somebody, or they're dying. And barbecue, old school barbecue, is really hard work. And so there's just very few people that want to do that. So I think that's one reason why things are closing. Second thing is the gentrification of a lot of black neighborhoods. So the black neighborhood barbecue joint becomes a destination joint. So as black people move to other parts of town, if they don't come back to that place and support it, you know, it's going to die out. And then the other thing is that place has been around for years. The white neighbors move in and start complaining about the smoke. And then all of a sudden you're getting all these violations, right? So that kind of stuff happens. And then the third part is the shift in barbecue. Barbecue, whether people wanted to acknowledge it or not, was based on a black aesthetic. It was the way that these black people cooked it that defined barbecue. Okay. What's been happening in the last couple of decades is now barbecue has a white aesthetic. So the way that white dudes are saying barbecue should be made is now becoming the norm. And so now, you know, people are more eating beef, right? They're being told that barbecue should not be sauced. They're being told that they should be using high quality meat like Kobe beef, Wagyu, all, you know, prime, all that stuff.
So there's a great quote in your book, because I'm also from the school of, the meat barbecue should be about the meat. That should be the star. And the sauce is just a compliment. But I think you mentioned somewhere that there was places where it's about the sauce, and the sauce is so good, you don't need no meat.
Exactly. I mean, I've been to barbecue restaurants where I've served barbecue, and it was an ocean of sauce with little islands of meat poking through on my plate. That's how much the sauce was important. And then there are a number of restaurants that just serve sauce and bread. And so that showcases the sauce. But then also, if you think about it, it's a way for poor people to still go to that restaurant and get some sustenance, right? Because you're going to get filled eating white bread and sauce. And if the sauce is that good, you don't mind that.
Yeah, or the you mentioned the fat sandwich.
Oh, yeah. Well, so I went to this place. It was called Davis Grocery in Texas. It's not too far from Austin. And so I was just talking to this guy, and he was telling me about some of the interesting things he serves. And basically, he has this fat sandwich. You know, it's just like smoked fat, and you know, it's maybe to some people it may sound disgusting, but it just sounded so delicious. And then I just asked the guy, I said, well, so why do you have that sandwich? And he's like, oh, I've got customers that don't have teeth, and I just wanted them to be able to have something to eat. I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Hey, that's serving the community right there. It's like you're taking care of those people.
Exactly.
So, Adrian, before we leave, I have a couple more questions for you. So what would you say, and I know you briefly touched upon it a little bit, but maybe you can expand on, what would you say the state of barbecue is today? And you end the book on looking to the future and then and I think optimistic perspective, what would you say the future of culture and barbecue would be as well?
Yeah, well, I'm going to borrow from a guy named John Shelton Reed, because I think he broke down kind of what's happening in barbecue now. So you've got the classic working class joints that are pretty much doing barbecue the way it was done like 30, 40 years ago. Those places aren't as plentiful. And then you've got a lot of mainstream barbecue. It's what John Shelton Reed calls the International House of Barbecue places. there's a lot of them, right? So just chains. It's barbecue, but, you know, I don't know if we would celebrate it as the great stuff. And then you've got this upper echelon of just kind of like almost haute barbecue, as he describes it. So those are the folks like emphasizing high quality meats, lack of sauce, minimal seasoning. You know, it's almost like a fine dining chef's sensibility. And this is the places where you're paying $30 for ribs, a rack of ribs, $36 for a pound of brisket, you know, just crazy prices. Yeah. and then I think there's a fourth thing happening right now, where I call fusion barbecue. So, you know, there's always a quest for something new and something creative. So now you're starting to see American style barbecue fused with other traditions. Mainly, you know, there's always the Tex-Mex, right? But so that's like the breakfast tacos with brisket and, you know, things like that. Breakfast burritos with brisket. But then I'm seeing a lot.
They're delicious.
They are delicious. I'm seeing a lot more Asian barbecue, like Korean. I'm seeing Korean barbecue fused with American barbecue, Vietnamese, you know, like that kind of stuff. So it's interesting. And then in terms of the future, though, you know, I don't see barbecue's popularity waning anytime soon. I think some things we should be mindful of are just sustainability issues. Because the rate that we're eating meat and its effect on our planet, and I'm a hardcore carnivore, so I'm still going to eat meat, but we got to be mindful of the impact on the planet. There is a cost for this. Now, you're starting to see certain trends in barbecue that are acknowledging that. You're seeing more plant-based barbecue. So there are people that are smoking jackfruit, which is a fruit from Asia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you know what you're doing, you can make that have the taste and texture of pork. And some of it can be quite good. I've had a lot of bad jackfruit, but some of it can be good. You know, a lot of people are smoking portobello mushrooms and other meaty mushrooms. You've got other people that are taking roots and smoking them and then cutting them in a way that they resemble rib tips. Huh. So that's going on. Ooh. And then on the mad scientist end of things, and if consumers accept this stuff and the technology works, it will have tremendous impact on animal welfare and sustainability issue.
3D printing.
3D printing meat and then cloning meat. So, you know, if people embrace that, I mean, that's going to be significant.
You know, I used to be a real turnoff with anything like that. And I shared with our listeners on one article, a woman says, I switched my whole family to plant-based meats and they didn't even notice, you know, and then that just was like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. You know, what have I been eating? You know, did they switch already? Right. I mean, it's like I had the Korean Impossible Bulgogi bowl and I was like, you know, this is pretty good. It's better than Taco Bell meat. And then I'm like, wait a minute, is Taco Bell meat? Like, is that meat? Is that like, oh my gosh, I think we've probably been doing this a lot longer than what we think. You know, people talk about the size of chickens and you're getting chicken breasts that look like turkeys and, you know, all of these things. So what's really going on? We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you get an organically raised chicken, I mean, I could see most people saying like, hey, why y'all chintzing on the chicken here? What's the rest of this? Because a normal sized chicken is still filling, right? But it's just half the size of what you normally get. So,
yeah. So that's awesome. You know, just thinking like so open minded about it. But I really appreciate like that your book dug down into the history and tried to put some shine, like especially where you have so many figures that were in barbecue. I feel like they were even lost on somebody like me. And I've been hosting a barbecue show for the last couple of years. And so it's just good to learn about that.
Yeah, you know, it's unfortunate. We just haven't been good about carrying on these stories. And so they get lost. Fortunately, somebody did track them at some point, because a lot of my research is based on going through historical newspapers. So, you know, sometimes you hear people say, oh, this country's so racist. These cooks have never been celebrated. You know, for the most part, that has not been my experience. These cooks were celebrated in their time. Now, granted, there was often a context of racism, right? There was a lot of condescension that went with it. But the skill was noted. And with these barbecue people, a lot of them were noted. And it's interesting, as you go through time, like before the mid-1800s, when it came to barbecues, they would probably note who hosted it, how many people showed up. There might be some references to what was consumed.
Mm.
By the time you get to the turn of the 20th century, they're telling you how many people came. You're often getting the name of the cook. The cook might even be interviewed a little bit.
Okay.
You get an exhaustive list of what was cooked. So we get more foodie over time when you're looking at the newspaper coverage.
Mm. Speaking of that foodie, right now, everybody seems to give away their secrets, right? There's no secrets and they tell you everything. I kind of feel like Black folks don't do that.
Yeah. No, we keep a lot of things close. And, you know, so, and I understand why people do that, but there's, I saw this in a book. It was by this woman, Karen Hess. She wrote about something called, the Chinese call wok presents. So this is the idea that even with the recipe, you as a cook step into that role and you bring a whole, you bring a unique set of experiences and skills to that. And so a recipe is always going to be yours. And so, you know, I have no problem giving people my recipes unless somebody has sworn me, you know, to secrecy until death.
Mm.
And of course, I do mention that. I don't believe I'm under any current restriction like that right now. I know my sister is, but I don't think I am.
Okay.
But, you know, there was a story in my book, like this guy, this barbecue cook said, yeah, I was given this sauce recipe, but I was told I can't reveal it until I'm about to die. And he's like, well, how am I supposed to know that? How am I supposed to know when that's going to happen? Which I thought was pretty funny. But I think there's a cautionary tale here. So, you know, Aaron Franklin, the most recognized barbecue dude on the planet.
Love that
and
guy.
Who's made a ton of money off barbecue.
Yeah.
He was an open book. I mean, if you buy his book, he just tells you everything he does.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And look how much money that dude's made.
Well, and then Bon we got Appetit people holding said he on. He has the best brisket in the country, like 2008
right.
or something.
Right. And now we've got all these people, brothers and sisters, especially holding on to stuff. And, you know, often in that case, somebody will figure out what they're holding on to and make a decent copy of it and then just start making ton of, you know, just start mass producing it and making a ton of money.
Mm.
So, you know, I understand why people do that, but I think, if you're going to hold on to a secret, at least try to capitalize on it. You know, bottle that sauce, get that spice rub marketed, although that's a rough market. So, but, you know, figure out ways that you can make money off this stuff.
Yeah, Stubblefield done it, right? Sugar Ray.
Yeah, Baby Ray's. Sweet Baby Ray's.
Baby Ray's. I can't think
of
Yeah,
you know, that's a couple of white dudes, right? You know that, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Sweet Baby Ray's is a couple of white dudes that won. There was a big Chicago rib contest that happened in the 80s and 90s. It doesn't really happen anymore, at least not on the same scale. So they came in first place or second place at that. And that gave them the courage to go out and just start marketing that sauce. And look where they are now. I think they're the world's, or at least in the U.S., I think they're the best-selling sauce now.
I think I'm going to have to tell my dad, hey, Pops, sit down. I got to give you some news. This sauce that you've been raving about all your life. Because, you know, he says it with the twang there. Sweet Baby Ray's, you know, like, it just, wow, okay. You know?
Yep.
Interesting facts. So, man, Adrian, besides writing a barbecue plant book next, what else are you planning on doing?
Yeah, I'm not going to write a barbecue plant book. although that'd probably be very lucrative, so maybe I should think about it. But, Yeah, no, I'm going to write next about black street vendors. I'm going to show how they shape the foods of places like New Orleans, Charleston, D.C., Philly, New York, Chicago, how they represented Africa and the way they dressed, the way they used their voices, the way they carried the food and the foods that they introduced and the dishes that they popularized. And then the really cool thing is that in the late, between, say, 1880s to 1920s, a lot of people would listen to these street cries. And, you know, that's what they called when the people were trying to get you to buy their stuff, get your attention. And they wrote them down to sheet music. So I have all this sheet music. So what I would love to do is to have a book that would have a compilation of the street cries. And I would hire, I would put them in context and I would hire somebody to sing them. And then, you know, you would know what it sounded like in New York in 1890s, somebody getting you to buy their stuff.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be. That is an incredible find, too. Like, how do you find that stuff?
Well, so check this out, man. I mean, they're in a lot of places, but believe it or not, many of these situations are in old newspapers. So they would print the bars and scales in the article. So now what does that tell you about what they thought about their readers, right? To just assume they had that musical knowledge. Can you imagine a newspaper article today? Right. Can you imagine a newspaper article today? I mean, a general newspaper having that?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, we don't read newspapers anymore. You got to put that on a Twitter or a tweet or something or a TikTok. Yeah, nobody's going to read music.
Exactly, right?
All right. Well, man, this is fantastic. I have to be honest. I think just in the short time we talked about your book, it doesn't really do it justice on the wealth of knowledge that you got in that book. I really appreciate it. You shouted out so many people in there back then and now. And even like one, Sylvie Curry, been trying to get her on the show for a couple of years. But it's just, you know, I really, like I said, it's just, I feel like it's really well researched. And you just feel like you're learning so much, you know, reading that book. So I want to encourage all the listeners to get the book, get the audio book, check it out. It's really fantastic. Adrian, would you like to say anything before we close the show?
No, man. You know, I just hope I just say this. All of my works, whether it was on Soul Food, The Presidential Cooks or barbecue, I think of my work as an appetizer. So, you know, I just hope people get interested in African-American food history and celebrate it. You know, one of the things that really sparked me to do this work is like, why is everybody else's food being celebrated and not mine? And we got to get to cooking. And then, you know, the thing is, especially in this time, is we got to support the people who are cooking and selling food, because it's a very precarious time for running a food business. And, you know, there's a lot of people trying to, you know, get some scratch, but also, you know, feed people, nourish the soul, and do other things. So I hope we can just do what we can to support them. Oh, I did forget. I almost forgot. I can't believe I got to get better about this. Please follow me on social media. I'm Soul Food Scholar on almost every platform that will get me. I'm so close to 32,000 followers on Instagram. So if you could just follow a brother, you can put me on mute after you follow me, but just please follow me. I just want to get to that level.
I have been following you, and I'm like, wait, this dude's in Norway? He's supposed to be on our show.
Yep. Miracle of technology.
Thank you again, Adrian, for joining us. I thoroughly enjoyed our talk today. And I, again, will echo Jay's call to our listeners. I highly encourage you to pick up the book. I will make sure to drop that in the show notes and on the website at thegrillcoach.com. And I look forward to reading your next book on street food. That sounds really exciting.
Yeah, it's going to be next level.
All right, Adrian. Mr. Miller, really appreciate you coming on the show. Just want to encourage keep doing what you're doing, because it's like you seem like to be one of the few voices that are doing that. And we'd love to have you back on when you have your next book out, or even just come back on and talk some more cooking stuff. And I want to just encourage every listener to go get a book, and still, I don't want you to miss an opportunity
to get out there and grill. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Grill Coach. Also, check out our blog at thegrillcoach.com for more episodes of our podcast, as well as other great grilling-related content.
Oh yes, it's about that time to light it up and go outside. We're chilling, grilling up sides and drinks, rubs and recipes and cooking techniques. Outdoor cooking, grilling, smoke and barbecue. So much flavor to teach and learn and share with you. Grill Coaches Podcast to level up your game with Frankie, Wes, and Jay.